Tonight is February 20th, and we are up to Perek Yud Zayin Vicheskel, chapter 17. As I mentioned last week, some Mefarshim say that this is actually the beginning of Yecheskel, meaning this is his first nevuah, his first prophecy. We know for a fact that Perek Aleph, the first chapter, is not his first prophecy. And the question then is, when is the first one? And some say this is it, and you'll see why that may be the case. So, let us begin. This is actually a very interesting parak. Vayhi divar Hashem elai le'mor, the word of Hashem was to me saying, Ben Adam, chud chida u'mishal mashal, say a secret and say a parable. Al beis Yisrael to the house of Yisrael. V'amarta, and you should say, chida could also be a riddle. V'amarta, you should say, Komar Hashem Elokim, so this is Hashem God, Hanesher HaGadol, the big eagle, Gedola Knafayim, with the big wings, Erech Ha'ever, with the long limbs, which mean wingspan, Malei Hanotzah, full of feathers, Ashalo HaRikma, that has the beauty, Bo'el HaLevanon, came to the forest, Vayikach Es Tzameres Ha'erez, and took the foliage of the cedar tree. Eis roshini kosav katof, the tips of its branches he cut off. Vayivyehu al eretz Canaan, and he brought it to the land of Canaan. This does not mean Eretz Israel. We'll explain this in a moment. Bi'ir rochlim samo, in the city of merchants he placed it. See, the word Canaan can mean merchants or salesmen. We find that usage in several places in Tanakh. Kenanim Asharat Sarfas, in Ovadia, for example, the word Kenanim can mean merchants. And here that's what it means. Allah is Kenan to the land of merchants, to the city of salesmen he put it. Vayikach Mizera Haaretz, he took from the seed of the land. Vayitneu Bistezar, and he put it into a field of seeds. Koch Al Mayim Rabim, he had it take root in a lot of water. Tzaf tzafa samo, he put it as a tzaf tzafa. A tzaf tzafa is a type of arava. An arava is, what's an arava? A willow, right. A tzaf tzafa is a type of willow. Actually, it's not kosher for lulav and esrog, but it is a type of willow. Vayitzmach, and it grew. Vayhi legefen sorachas, and it became a big vine. Shiflas koma, that was low of height. I mean, it was big, but it was hanging low. Lifnos doliosav elav, to turn its branches to it, meaning to the eagle. Visharashav tachtav yu, and its roots will be under it. Vayhi legefen, it became a vine. Vatas madim, and it made branches, made strong branches, v'teshalach paros, and it sent off its branches that would grow, its grapes that would grow from it, its branches and leaves. V'hin nasher echad gadol, and there was a large eagle, meaning this is a different one, gadol kenafayim, which had big wings, v'rav notzah, a lot of feathers, v'hinei ha'gefen hazos, and behold, this vine, Kafna Sharasheha Alav, turned its roots to it, to the new eagle. Vidali Osav Shokalo, and its branches it sent to it. Lahashkos Osa, to water it. Mearugos Mata'a, from the furrows of he who planted it, meaning from the first eagle. The first eagle had made furrows around the vine for it to catch water, and now it's sending those that benefit to the second eagle. El Sadeh Tov, to a good field. El Mayim Rabim Hishesulah, on good water it is planted. Lasos Anaf Velaseis Peri, to make branches and to make fruit. Lios Lagefen Adares, to be a glorified or beautiful vine. Amar say, Komar Hashem Elokim, so says Hashem Elokim, Titzlach, will you be successful? Haloes Sharasheha Yinatek, behold, its roots will be cut off. Ves piryah yekoseis v'yavesh, and its fruit will be thrown down and will dry up. Kol tarpei tzimcha tivash, all of its growth will dry out. V'lo v'yizroa gedola uva'amrav l'masos osam yishara sheha. And not with strong arms or big arms and a large nation to help it from that which is coming to uproot it. V'ine shesula, behold, it is planted. Hasitzlach, will it succeed? Halokegas baruach hakadim tivash yavesh. When the easter wind touches it, it will surely dry up. Ala rugos tzimcha tivash, on its the place where it's been planted, it will dry up. This is obviously a mashal, and normally we will be left to understand, try to figure out what is this mashal coming to teach us. What is it all about? We have two eagles. We have this vine which is growing. We have this cedar whose branches have been taken away, and it would seem we'd have to work out what it is. In this case, for some reason, the Hashem decides to actually tell Yechezkel what it all means, and the second half of the perek, starting from Pasuk Yod Aleph and on, is the explanation for the first half of what happened over here. So what we are going to do is we're going to read the rest of the perek and then go back to the mashal. The second half of the parak is the easier part to read because it's clear. It's not a parable, it's straightforward. Then we will go back to the first part of the parak and look at the particulars of the mashal. But let's just review the story quickly. Hashem says that there's this large eagle, this beautiful eagle with a big wingspan, many feathers. It comes to the forest and takes away, it comes to a cedar tree and takes away all of its branches. It takes apparently one of the branches, I guess it's one of the branches, and goes and plants it in the city of merchants. There, this sapling grows. First it's a willow, then it becomes a vine. So it's changing, it's growing, but it's changing in the mashal. It goes from being a cedar tree, a branch from a cedar tree, to being a willow, to being a vine. And then it grows and it becomes beautiful, it becomes big. And the purpose of it is, the reason why the eagle does this, is that this vine should provide branches and fruit for the eagle. Then there's another eagle that comes on the scene, which is also a large eagle, also with many feathers. And this vine chooses to give its branches and its fruit to the new eagle rather than to the old eagle. And to this Hashem says, will you be successful? No, everything will be destroyed. The roots will be destroyed. The fruit will dry up. And it will not be successful. So, if we were to try to figure out, those who have not looked ahead, we were trying to figure out what is this a mashal for, what would we say?
Jewish people
and Hashem, the first one who planted them,
whatever, and then the second eagle
is God's, that they go to, and it's not going to work. Okay, so the first eagle is Hagadosh Baruch Hu, and the sapling is us. What's the cedar tree? Okay, a branch from the, okay, that's good. And he planted us, and we grew, and everything was good, and then we decided to give our fruit and our branches to the second eagle, which would be what?
The idols,
Avodah Zarah. And Hashem says, will you be successful? No, you will not be successful. So I would have said that also. And I think that's why, at least that's the simple reason why, the Navi now has to tell us what the mashal really is about, because I would have said the exact same thing. Because that's been the pattern. That's been the pattern in Yechezkel. But we're going to see that this is really completely different. Something else to say? No. Okay. Anybody have anything else that was not basically along those lines? Okay. So now let's see what it's really about. It's actually startling. Vahid v'ar Hashem elai le'mor, the word of Hashem was to me saying, we're up to Pasuk now, Yud Beis 12. Amar na levei Samari, say now to the house of rebellion, meaning the Jews. Halo yedatem ma'ela, don't you know what this is? Amar say, Hineva melech Bavel Yerushalayim. Behold, the king of Bavel will come to Yerushalayim. He came to Yerushalayim. Vayikach es malkav es sareha, and he took its king and its officers. And he brought them to him to Babel. This is referring to, let's recall the history over here. I know we've gone through this several times. Nebuchadnezzar becomes king over Babel. Babel becomes a world power. The second year of his reign, he goes and attacks Yerushalayim and successfully defeats Yerushalayim. And the king of Yerushalayim at that time was? What's that? Not Zedekiyahu? What's that? Not Yechaniah. Both of you have good guesses, but neither is correct. Yehoyakim. Yehoyakim, who is the father of Zedekiyahu, Yehoyakim is the one who becomes, who is the king. Speaking of who the, Yehoyakim is the king. He takes, I don't want to say he's the father of Zedekiah, I thought it was the father of, I just read today the father of Zedekiah, I think he's the father of Yechaniah. Let's leave out who's the father of, because I don't want to say the wrong thing. But he's the king, he was not a tzaddik, and he gets taken away by Nebuchadnezzar, he doesn't get taken away, let's start differently. He gets subjugated by Nebuchadnezzar. That's the first thing that happened. He gets subjugated by Nebuchadnezzar. And now, Eretz Yisrael becomes a tributary to Nebuchadnezzar. Now, then he leaves, Nebuchadnezzar leaves, goes back, and presently, Yehoyakim rebels against Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar comes back a second time, again defeats Yehoyakim, this time kills him because of what he did, or takes him to Babel at least, and takes away everybody else. And now he appoints Yechaniah to be king in place of Yehoyakim. He appoints his son Yehoyakim to be the king, Yechaniah. Then he goes back to Babel. He gets back to Babel, and his advisors say to him, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. How could you appoint his son, the person who rebelled against you, how could you appoint his son to be king? Nebuchadnezzar says, you're right. Turns around, and a year later, because of how long it took to travel, gets back to Eretz Israel. This is his third time in Yerushalayim. This time he takes Yechaniah into Gullus, and this is the first of the two Gulluses that we're talking about. That's where he takes Yechaniah and Yechezkel and Mordechai and Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and all the other leadership of the Jews into Gullus to Babel. And he appoints as a puppet king Zedekiyahu. Zedekiyahu is king for 11 years, and after 11 years, Zedekiyahu also has rebelled, and Nebuchadnezzar comes back for a fourth time, and this time destroys the Beis HaMikdash and takes everybody else into Gullus. Now we know that Sefer Yechezkel takes place during those 11 years. We had in the beginning of Yechezkel, it was the fifth of those 11 years. This is going to be a little earlier than that, as we said. This is really previous to the beginning of Yechezkel. And this is describing that first Gullus. Hashem says that Melech Babel came to Yerushalayim and he took its king and its officers. See, Rashi says it's Yehoyakim. I would have thought this was about Yechaniah, but he says it's Yehoyakim and his officers, and brought them to Babel. Vayikach mizera melucha, and he took from the Pasuk Yud Gimel, the 13, and he took from the seed of the melucha, of the kings. This is Zedekiyahu. Vayichros ito beris, and he made with him a covenant. Vayaveo sovi Allah, and he brought him into an oath. He made Zedekiyahu swear to him. And the strong ones of the land he took. All the Nevi'im, all the Talmidei Chacham he took with him to Babel, and he left Zedekiyahu in charge, but he didn't just leave him in charge. He made Zedekiyahu swear to him. He brought him into an oath, a covenant. Lios Mamlacha Shefala, to be a lowly nation. Livyolti Hisnasei, that they should not rule. Lishmar Espriso La'amda, to guard his covenant, to stand it up, to protect it. Vayimrad Bo, and Zedekiyahu rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. Lishlach Malachav Mitzrayim, to send his messengers to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. Lases Lo Susim, that Egypt should give to Zedekiyahu horses, which would be the equivalent of tanks. Ve'am Rav, and a great amount of, and great, a lot of people, that would be infantry. Hayitzlach, will he be successful? Hayimaleit, will he escape? Ha'oseilo, the one who does this? The Hefer Bris, that he nullified the covenant. Venimlat, and he'll escape? Tzidkiyahu violated the oath that he had made to Nebuchadnezzar. So Hashem says, are you going to be successful? Will you escape if you act that way? Chai ani numa Hashem Elokim. I swear, says Hashem God, im lo b'makom ha-melech ha-mamlich oso, if not in the place, b'mkom ha-melech ha-mamlich oso, in the place of the king that made him king, which means Nebuchadnezzar made Tzidkiyahu king, so in the place of the one who made you king, which means in Bavel, where Nebuchadnezzar is, asher bazas alaso, that you have degraded, defiled his oath, basher heferes briso, and you have nullified his covenant, itov v'soch Bavel yamus, with him in Bavel you will die. Yitzkiyo will have to be brought to Bavel for having gone in against the covenant, against the oath, and you will die. V'lo v'chayel gadol v'kahol rav yase oso faro v'amilchama, and not with with great armies and many people will Paro do for you in war. Now, you sent to Egypt to help you out. It's not going to happen. Egypt will turn their back on you. Bishvoch solalah, when they pour the dirt. This is referring to when Nebuchadnezzar comes to besiege Jerusalem in order to get over the walls. They're going to pour dirt, as we described this before in Yechezkel, and make a higher and higher hill to climb up on top of to be able to shoot over the walls of Yerushalayim. Well, we've noticed Dayek, and when they build ramparts, la'achris nefashos rabos, to cut off many souls. Mitzrayim will not come to help you when this happens. U'bazah Allah lehafer bris, and when you defiled the oath, and when you nullify the covenant, and behold, you gave your hand, which means you made an oath. You gave your hand as a form of asking for Nebuchadnezzar's trust. You did all this. Lo yimaleit, you will not escape. Therefore, says Hashem God, Chayani, I swear, imlo alasi asher baza, if not my oath that you have degraded, ubrisi asher hefir, and my covenant that you have defiled, you have nullified, urisatif brosho, and I will give it in his head, which means I'll pay him back. Ufarasti olav rishti, and I will spread upon him my trap, v'nispas b'mtsunasi, and he will be caught in my trap. Rishti is actually my net. And I'll be caught in my trap. I'll bring him to Bavel, v'nishpati ito sham, and I will judge him there. Ma'alo asher mo'al bi, the iniquity that he has done against me. Ve'es kol mivrachav b'chol agapav b'cherav yipolu, and all of those who escaped, and all of his army, they will be killed in war. V'nisharim, and all those who remain, l'choruach yiparesu, they will be scattered in all directions. V'idatem ki ani Hashem vibarti, you will know that I am Hashem, I have spoken. So, what is Tzidkiyahu going to be punished for? Violating his oath. What oath?
To be true.
What about the oath to Nebuchadnezzar? See, it sounds like he's being punished for going against his oath and his covenant with Nebuchadnezzar, which starts off being called the oath of Nebuchadnezzar, and later Hashem calls it my oath and my covenant. This has to be understood. Is it the Nebuchadnezzar's oath and covenant, or is it Hashem's? Yeah. Nebuchadnezzar? Whatever it is, yeah.
He, by swearing an oath to him, obviously,
he can't vote to Hashem. He can't swear allegiance to Hashem. Okay.
At all. So when he
rebels,
then he wants to come back to Hashem. So.
Okay, good. Let's hold that thought. Okay, good. So let's keep it. It does seem to need some explanation that gets on the right track. So let's keep that thought. Let's just read the rest of the parak. A few more pesukim. Chaf Beis. Komar Hashem Elokim, says Hashem God. V'lokachti ani, I will take mitzameres ha'erez. Then we're getting back to the parable. Well, I'm going to take from the branches of the cedar tree. Harama, the tall one, the great one. Vinasati, and I will place it, which means I'll make it, I'll give it strength. Merosh Yon Kosav, from the top of its branches. Rach Ektof, I will cut up a soft one. Vishasalti Ani, and I will plant it. Alhar Gavoa, on a tall mountain. Visolul, Solul is another word for height. A tall, grand mountain. Behar Merom Yisrael Eshtalenu, on a mountain of the heights of Yisrael, I will plant it. Vinasa Anaf, it will carry branches. V'asa feri, it will make fruit. V'hayala erez adir, will be for a grand cedar. V'shachnu sachtav, and they will dwell under it. Kol tzipar, kol kanaf, all types of birds. V'tzel d'liosav tishkona, in the shade of its branches they will dwell. V'yadu, and they will know. Kol asei asada, all the trees of the field. Ki ani Hashem, that I am God. He spalt the eight skavoa, I have diminished the tall tree. He gabat the eight shafol, I have raised up the low tree. Hovash the eight lach, I have dried up the moist tree. The hifrach the eight salvation, I have made flower the dried out tree. Ani Hashem, I have God. Dibarti the osisi, I have spoken and I have done. So we come back to the mashal here at the end of the parak. The mashal and the nimshal work as follows. The tree is, of course, the Jewish people, or more specifically, the kings, the Malchus Beis David, the royalty of the Jewish people. The first eagle is Nebuchadnezzar, that he came and he cut off the branches. He took all of the leadership. He took the king, Yechaniah, he took everybody. He took all the leadership, all the Nevi'im, took them away. He then took one small branch and he planted it. Almayim Rabin, he planted it with a lot of water, meaning he gave it a chance to grow. But he wanted it to grow only to pay tribute to him, and only to be a lowly nation, not to be a strong nation. That sapling grew into first a willow. A willow has no fruit, has nothing to give, to offer. Then it grew into a vine, which is not a tall tree, but it has obviously redeeming qualities. And that was Tzidkiyahu. That is symbolic of Tzidkiyahu, who Nebuchadnezzar took and gave him royalty. Then this very Tzidkiyahu turned around and sought out another eagle, another powerful nation. That was Mitzrayim. Hoping that Mitzrayim would, Egypt would help him against Nebuchadnezzar, to throw off the yoke of Nebuchadnezzar. And Hashem says, but because you betrayed the first eagle, therefore you will not be successful, and at the end you will be cut down and destroyed. Now, what we need to understand, among other things, is what is this oath and what is this covenant with Nebuchadnezzar? What is the violation of it going to Mitzrayim? And why does it bother Hashem? Is it bad that Tzidkiyahu rebels against Nebuchadnezzar? I would have thought it's good to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. What is this Nebuchadnezzar's oath, Hashem's oath? So we have a suggestion that perhaps when he makes an oath to Nebuchadnezzar, that in itself is throwing off the yoke of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the problem with that is that then he should be punished for having made the oath in the first place. It seems from the way the mashal plays itself out that Tzidkiyahu is being punished not for having made the oath with Nebuchadnezzar, but for having violated it and turned to Mitzrayim. Yeah?
Was it like nowadays we put our hand on the Bible when we swear something? Was it like you were swearing in the name of your God back then?
Yes. And therefore? Good. Therefore?
Therefore, he swore within Hashem's name and then he went against.
Okay, excellent. The issue over here is, he violated an oath. The oath was made to Nebuchadnezzar, and then he violated it. But you can't go against an oath. A neder, a swear, a promise, is binding. And when someone violates that, that's very serious. Now, what was the oath? And this is a piece of information you wouldn't you wouldn't know from the Pesukim. I'm going to share it with you. It's from the Gemara. It's the Gemara in Nedarim says this. And it's a striking Gemara. The Gemara says, Tzidkiyahu found Nebuchadnezzar one day eating a live rabbit. Now, the Mefarshim explain that when someone is in battle, they often lose their sense of civility. That's normal. As you know, that's the parsha of Yefas Toar in the Chumash, in Parshas Kisese, which we don't need to get into now. But it is a known fact that in war, when a person is struggling with killing people and trying to avoid being killed, it is normal for a person to lose their civility. But, and therefore, the way one conducts themselves, the way one eats, the way one acts, the way one talks, would not be the way one would do in polite and civil company. However, Nebuchadnezzar was demonstrating this to a much higher degree. He was hungry in the war, and he grabbed a live rabbit and began to eat it. And Tzidkiyahu saw him do it. Tzidkiyahu was the only one who saw him do it. Nebuchadnezzar said to Tzidkiyahu, I do not want you to tell anybody about what you witnessed. I want you to swear to me that you will never divulge that you saw me eating this live rabbit. And Tzidkiyahu agreed and swore that he would never divulge it. The Gemara says, after many years, Tzidkiyahu was having tsar gadol, great pain, at not being able to divulge this information. And he went to the Sanhedrin. And he said to the Sanhedrin, I need to get my oath removed. And the Sanhedrin heard his case and removed the oath for him. As you know, if a person makes a vow, an oath, they can go and remove the oath. The problem is that you're not allowed, normally, to remove an oath that was made to somebody else unless that other person is there. Meaning, if I take an oath that I will fast for 4 days, and then I change my mind, I can go to a Beis Din, or to a Chacham, or to a Sanhedrin, and ask if I can get it removed. And depending on the circumstances, depending on whether there's extenuating circumstances, perhaps they can remove it, perhaps they can't. It depends. They will question me, etc. But if I make an oath to my wife, for example, that I'll do the laundry for 4 days, and then I decide that that's too hard, I don't want to do it, then I can't just go get it removed unless my wife comes with me, because she's the one I made the oath to. So over here, where Tzidkiyahu had made the oath to Nebuchadnezzar, really the rules would be that Nebuchadnezzar needs to be there in order for Sanhedrin to remove the oath. However, Sanhedrin were bound to listen to Tzidkiyahu, because he was the king. And they felt pressured by him to listen and to remove the oath. And so they did. And then Tzidkiyahu gave away the information. Nebuchadnezzar heard people talking about what he had done, and he knew the only person who ever knew about it was Tzidkiyahu. So he went, and he called Tzidkiyahu on the carpet. He said, what'd you do? When he caught Tzidkiyahu, when he came to attack Yerushalayim, he caught Tzidkiyahu. Remember the story we learned in Yechezkel earlier? Tzidkiyahu had a tunnel to try to escape. Who remembers what happened when he tried to escape? How'd they get him at the other end, though? It was a hidden tunnel. Anybody remember? Hashem brought a deer, and the soldiers were hunting the deer, and the deer kept eluding the soldiers, and finally the deer went right in front of the entrance to the cave, and when Tzidkiyahu came out, that's when the deer came by and they saw Tzidkiyahu. That's what's referred to over here as the trap and the net that Hashem placed for Tzidkiyahu. He gets caught. Nebuchadnezzar asks him, why'd you do this? And he says, well, actually, there's two different versions of what happened. Rashi in Eicha says that Nebuchadnezzar called the Sanhedrin before him. And he said to the Sanhedrin, read me your Torah. And they started telling him the Torah. And they got all the way to the parasha of Nedarim, which is in Parashas Matos. And in Nedarim, when they finally got to that parasha, about oaths and vows. Nebuchadnezzar said, well, what if someone wants to remove an oath or a vow? They said, well, you have to go to a chacham to remove the oath. So he said, oh, so that means you're telling me that Tzidkiyahu could only have removed his oath through you. And that's how he caught both Tzidkiyahu and the Sanhedrin at what they had done. And therefore, he killed the Sanhedrin, and Tzidkiyahu, he punished him. We already learned this before. First he had, this is important for this parak anyway, first he had Tzidkiyahu's sons killed in front of Tzidkiyahu, then he blinded Tzidkiyahu's eyes and took him to Babel, which is where Tzidkiyahu lived the rest of his life and died. Hashem is saying to Tzidkiyahu that he's going to be punished because he violated the oath. Yep. That's the question. That's one of the questions. What's this urge to tell? Why does he have to tell? It's so difficult for him to keep quiet.
And also, if he punishes the Sanhedrin,
it's a good question. Tyson's asked this question. The question over there is, why would Tzidkiyahu want that? It seems to be that lechatchila, you're not supposed to do it, but the evidence does work, but it's not the best thing to do. They shouldn't have done it. It's not the most terrible thing, but they shouldn't have done it. It seems also there's an element here of Chilul Hashem. Because he took an oath, and then he goes against it.
Does the oath to a non-Jew
admit that
there's
one? So is it called
the same strength as Jew to Jew? Or
same strength.
Pardon?
Same strength. Take an oath, you got to keep it. Yeah. So what's this big pain? Why can't he hold it in? Why does he have to tell about a relatively minor thing, apparently, that Nebuchadnezzar ate this rabbit? What's the big deal?
Maybe he had a flaw himself and he had someone else
bother him. Okay. Okay. Perhaps.
And it's also very hard to hold things that are stupid like that. Obviously, it didn't bother him.
Okay, it's hard to keep a secret. But, I mean, it can't be that hard. I was saying it's hard to keep a secret, but here, you know, he had made an oath to the king who was the ruler over the entire known world and had sweeping powers.
But it must be very revolting to him what he did.
So right? Really bothered him. There must be some kind of terrible urge, right? Okay. Okay, it seems that his urge was to let the world know what kind of a person Nebuchadnezzar was. Meaning, Tzidkiyahu was made the puppet king over Eretz Yisrael. Nebuchadnezzar was not a pleasant person. The Gemara says that as long as Nebuchadnezzar was in power, nobody smiled. Now that's probably an exaggeration, but the point is, there was very little schok, very little joy in the world as long as Nebuchadnezzar was king. When he died, finally, in Babel, after many years, the Gemara says that there was schok, there was joy in the world. He was not a nice person, and he was a difficult person. Tzidkiyahu was made the puppet king. In the beginning, he pledged allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar. But as time went on, it would seem he became more and more fed up with Nebuchadnezzar and had to divulge this information. Do you know what kind of person, when people were praising Nebuchadnezzar and talking about how great he was, he had this urge to say really what kind of person he was, what kind of terrible person he was. And finally, he could stand it no longer and went to the Sanhedrin to remove the oath. Yeah?
This time the no cut laws are in effect.
Yes.
It's like the tearing of the live animal.
Yes.
So is that part of it, that he was going against the no cut law?
That Nebuchadnezzar was? Sure. Oh, you mean, was that the reason why he had to give it away? Could be. It could be. There is a difference of opinion. I told you the most prevalent opinion, which is that he ate a live rabbit. The other way to read it is he ate a raw rabbit, which would at least mitigate that. But, as I said, most of the Marshall learned it was a live rabbit. Yeah.
also seems very strange that, I mean, here he is, Nebuchadnezzar is in power, he's letting him be the king. The public king of Jerusalem is taking a chance to go tell him and make him angry.
So Figgioh seems to have thought that he could do this and be helped by Mitzrayim, by Egypt. That's what it seems is going on over here. It seems that he would not have given it away if he thought that his kingdom would be in shambles, he'd be destroyed. He thought he could turn to Paro in Egypt to help him out with horses and with infantry. And Hashem says that's not going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen is not because it was wrong to turn to Egypt, but because you can't violate an oath. It's an unbelievable thing that because he violated the oath, therefore Hashem says he has no hope. He will be destroyed. Let's just stop for a moment and focus on taking oaths, just for a few moments before we get back to the story. It should be known, and if you speak to any of my children, they will tell you this, they will tell you they hear this from me all the time, but you should know that if there is anything you want to make sure never, ever, ever to do, don't take oaths. Don't swear, don't promise. Ever. Don't ever do it. It is extremely, extremely dangerous. The Gemara has all kinds of terrible, terrible things that happen when a person takes an oath or a promise or a vow and doesn't keep it. And therefore, one should never, ever do it. My kids hear all the time, don't promise. Never, ever promise. Never promise. Don't say the word. Don't let it come out of your mouth. Don't say the word, I swear. Never, never let those words come out of your mouth. We think it's just words. Okay, so it's another mitzvah in the Torah. But it's not just another mitzvah in the Torah. You see here the destruction that was wrought because of violating an oath. It's not coincidental that we start Yom Kippur with Kol Nidre. It's not just that, you know, Kol Nidre is a nice thing. What's Kol Nidre about? It's all about taking oaths. It's all about making sure that we're not bound by our oaths. Because one who takes an oath and doesn't keep it, it's extremely dangerous. The punishments are horrific. And one should never, ever do it. If we have never heard this before, this story in itself should warn us to always be careful and never, ever to do it. And if we ever hear someone who we have influence over swearing or promising or anything like that, that we should always stop it. Always tell them never to do it. You want to say, I'm going to try my best. That's fine. I'm never say I give you my word. Nothing like that, ever. Should never ever say anything along those lines. Anything being taken as an oath or a vow should never ever escape our lips. Yeah. If you said bli neder, then it's not a neder. Now, so this is the next step to this discussion, which is that if you say you're going to do a mitzvah, not, you haven't done it yet, but I say I'm going to do a mitzvah. I say, for example, I'm going to learn, or I'm going to do a chesed. If I say I'm going to do a mitzvah, that is binding like an oath. Even if you don't say, I swear I'm going to do it. If I say I'm going to eat lunch, and then I don't eat lunch, it's not an oath. But if I say that I'm going to do a chesed, and then I don't do it, it is an oath. So that's why when one is ready to do a mitzvah, and says I'm going to do a mitzvah, one should always say bli neder. Bli neder is without an oath, meaning that I'm going to do this mitzvah, bli neder. That's the appropriate usage of the words bli neder. If I say I'm going to eat lunch, I don't have to say bli neder because I didn't take an oath. So there's no need to say bli neder. The phrase bli neder is used in context of doing a mitzvah. I'm going to daven bli neder. That's the appropriate usage of bli neder. That's okay. Thinking it's all right. Yeah, just in speech. That's okay. That's okay. That's not a mitzvah. It's true. It's better to be, you know, but it's not a mitzvah. This is why, as you know, for a bris, we don't invite to a bris, but we inform about a bris. And the same is true, really, about a wedding, and the same is true about a pidyon haben or anything like that. We're really informing. It's true we say in a wedding invitation a person's invited, but that's because the wedding has several parts to it. And we're not inviting. The thing is this. The seuda, the meal, is a sudas mitzvah with a bris or with a pidyon haben or with a chasana. So we invite someone to the meal. That means if they say yes, they've agreed to come to do a mitzvah. And then if they back out, they're going against an oath. So that's why we only inform, so a person doesn't have to go, he can refuse. There's no issue over there about inviting someone to do a mitzvah or someone agreeing to do a mitzvah. It's just we're informing them there is such a mitzvah available. When you say yes, you're coming to a wedding, you don't mean you're coming to the meal, even though that is what's implied, but that's not what you're saying yes to, and therefore you don't have the same problem over there. The other issue, which was just mentioned, is that if you do a mitzvah or do a hanhaga tova, a good way of acting, three times, that also becomes an oath. So if I never said I was going to do it, but then I say to Hillel three times, I just said, you know what, I'm going to try to say to Hillel every day. I never said those words. But I'm going to try. After the third day, it becomes like an oath. It becomes binding like an oath, because I did it three days in a row. That's binding. So therefore, one should also endeavor to say Bli Neder before doing a Hanhaga Tova, a good way of acting, three times. For the same reason, to mitigate this issue of taking oaths, taking vows. It's something which one should try to keep in mind, not to get stuck in that kind of situation where one has taken a vow. Yeah?
So if you're doubting for someone during Shemoneh Esrei, and you say that every time, then should you say whatever before you start?
Well, the thing is this, when you daven for someone in Shemoneh Esrei, so you're not agreeing to daven for that person forever. You mean to daven for that person as long as they're sick,
yeah.
Right? So if that's what you had in mind, then once you start that, then yeah, you're stuck with that for till the person gets better. But if you say Bli Neder, then you're not stuck with it. Now, when we do Kol Nidre before Yom Kippur, and also if you do Hataras Nadarim before Rosh Hashanah, those help for these sorts of things. Those help because what we're saying with Kol Nidre is that whenever I take or inadvertently take an oath, I'm right now at the beginning of the year saying it shouldn't be binding. So I'm giving my, I'm announcing in the beginning of the year that from here on in, whatever oath I take shouldn't be binding. So in some ways, the Kol Nidre helps for the future. So if you're stuck in that situation, you can always ask a Shaila, and the rabbi can tell you how to handle the situation if you want to stop doing it. But the best...
What's that?
Yeah, the mitzvah is to daven. You know, davening for that particular person, I don't know if that's a... that's going to be an oath or not. Because the mitzvah is to daven. And hopefully you say all the names, but I don't know that you're in trouble if you left out one name or left out another name. Yeah?
What do you mean by Hanhaga Tova?
A Hanhaga Tova?
Yeah.
The classic example for men is if a man says he's going to go to the mikveh every day.
Okay.
That's a classic example. He doesn't have to go to the mikveh every day, but it's a nice thing to do, right? And then he just starts doing it. If he does it three times, he's stuck. Starting Shabbos early is a good example. That's right. That's a good example. I'll tell you on Hagat Tova. Yeah.
Right.
That's a good example too. That's a good example too. If you initially thought about doing it only three times in a row, then that's it. That's what it is. It's only binding if you had in mind for more, and you started doing it, now you're stuck.
Well, if you had, whatever happens, you're okay.
Well, if you speak it out, then you're only stuck with whatever you said. See, the problem is when a person starts doing it, it doesn't think. Just starts doing it. Just goes. Once they do it three times, then they're in. But if you say I'm going to do it for a week, so after a week you're finished.
Just calling the attorney from the past year, asking for the litigation of the oath from the past, or you're talking about to the future, this year, anything that.
We say both. If you look in the text of Kol Nidre, you'll see it's for both last year and the following year. It does, but it doesn't. I don't want to get into the technicalities. It doesn't work for everything. It works for a lot of things. It doesn't work for everything. No. It covers more than that, but it's technical about when it's going to be in effect and when it's not. No, no. What we generally do is before Rosh Hashanah we have Ataras Nadarim. That's one way of doing it. And we have Kol Nidre. Those are the ways of doing it. If one is stuck because of a particular oath that they want to get out of, then they should ask a Shaila. Now, so Tzidkiyahu, therefore, Hashem has him punished for what he has done. And Nebuchadnezzar comes and takes him to Bavel. As we said, he's punished. Now, what ended up happening in Bavel? After Tzidkiyahu got taken to Bavel, that's 11 years after Yechaniah got taken to Bavel, Tzidkiyahu had many sons. His sons were the heir to the throne and also the descendants of David HaMelech. Tzidkiyahu's sons were killed in front of his eyes. And then he was blinded and taken to Bavel, where he died. Yechaniah, when he was taken into Golus 11 years earlier, had no children. So, where is the line of David HaMelech supposed to come from? It can't be a daughter. It has to be sons. The line of Mashiach has to go father to son. Can't go through daughters.
Someone had to have another child.
What happened is that Yechaniah, who did not have children in Eretz Yisrael, after he came to Bavel, and there he had a child. We'll learn about this later. That is what is meant in the end of this parak, starting from Chaf Beis. Chaf Beis is fascinating because this is the first reference that we have in Sefer Yechezkel. There will be more. This is the first reference that we have in Sefer Yechezkel to Mashiach. We've talked about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the two different galuses of Yechaniah and Tzidkiyahu. I have told you since the beginning of Yechezkel, things will become more upbeat as we move along. We're not really ready to go upbeat. We're going to still have some real downers coming up. But here we have our first reference to Mashiach. In Pasuk Chaf Beis, Hashem says, I will take from the branches of the cedar tree. The cedar tree is the line of David HaMelech. I will take from those branches, that tall cedar tree, I will take from the tips of its branches a soft branch, and I will plant it on a tall mountain, a high mountain. On a tall mountain, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Bahar Marom Yisrael Ashtalenu, I will plant it on this tall mountain in Eretz Yisrael, and it will carry branches, and it will make fruit, and it will be for a powerful cedar tree. They will dwell underneath it, all the birds of the field, underneath its branches, they will dwell. Meaning all of Klal Yisrael will find shade under the branches of Mashiach. And they will know, and all the trees of the field will know that I am Hashem. Meaning, everybody now will know that I am Hashem, all the nations of the world. I have lowered the high tree, and I have raised the low tree. The tall tree, Tzidkiyahu, I have thrown down. The low tree, meaning Mashiach, I have raised up. Hovash the eighth lach, I've dried up a moist tree. Tzidkiyahu, who had many children, I have dried him up. He now has no children. The Hifrach the Eitz Yavesh, and the dry tree, Yechaniah, who in Eretz Yisrael was not able to have children. And we know, of course, that Eretz Yisrael is the place where a person is more likely to have children. We know, for example, that when it says that Abraham and Sarah, after Abraham was together with Sarah for 10 years, and Sarah didn't have children, then Sarah said to Abraham, take my maidservant Hagar as a wife. But it wasn't 10 years, they'd been married a lot longer than 10 years. But Rashi tells us the years that they were in Chutz La'aretz didn't count. It's only the 10 years that they were in Eretz Yisrael that counted. Because Eretz Yisrael is the place where a person is more likely to have the children. And so, even so, Yechaniah, who was in Eretz Yisrael, did not have children. And now he's in Bavel, and that's where he has children. I have taken the dry tree, and I have made him flower. So says Hashem, I have spoken and I have said. In addition, and that's where the line of Mashiach comes from. Yechaniah's son's name is Zerubbabel. Who's familiar with the name Zerubbabel? From where are you familiar with? Where are you familiar with that from? It's in a song, don't we sing? Huh?
Oh, it's Shabbos.
Well, I don't know about Shabbos. Maybe it's Shabbos, but it's in Moses' Tzur. Kates Bavel Zerubbabel. The end of Bavel Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is a person's name. Zerubbabel is the son of Yechaniah. And even though he doesn't become king, because there are no kings in the second Beis HaMikdash, but that's where the line, he does become a leader, he's a Navi, that's where the line of David HaMelech comes from. And eventually Mashiach will come from there. There's also a reference over here to Yemos HaMashiach, the days of Mashiach, particularly in Pasuk Chaf Gimel, because the Pasuk says, V'nasa Anaf, 23, V'nasa Anaf, he will carry branches, V'asa Peri, and he will make fruit, V'ayala Erez Adir, and you will be for a great tree, a great cedar. So the Gemara tells us that in the time of Mashiach, I don't know if it's time of Mashiach, in the future times, trees, there are three things the Gemara says in the same place regarding these psukim. One, you will find, I don't know how you'll find it, but one is that trees will produce fruit every day. And that's what it means over here. Venasa anaf asa peri. It will be a daily occurrence. The fruit will come from the trees. A second thing is that the trees themselves will produce the wheat. The ground will produce fully baked bread. It will actually grow from the ground, meaning that as the branch comes up from the ground, the stalk will come up, and then you'll get into a more and more refined. Thing right now with the more and more refined part of the wheat is the kernel of wheat. As you move along, you get to the chaff, etc., and then you get down to the wheat kernel. In the time in the Lasid Lavo, that will continue until you get to actually a fully edible piece of bread that will actually grow from the ground. And it also says that clothing will grow as well, whatever that means. And then finally, it says that a woman will be able to give birth every day. Now, what that means is that the gestation period will be one day. That's what it means. It means that from conception to birth, it will be a one-day process, which means that the klala, the curse from Chava of difficulty with childbearing and child-rearing will be removed, and things will be a lot easier. It will be easy and smooth, etc., the way it was meant to be from the time Hashem created the world. All of that is in the future at some point in time. And that it's hinted to over here with Vinasa Anafa Asa Peri.
It's not
well, it's not mentioned over there. It does take away the men's curse to work, because if the bread is growing from the ground, you don't need... Yeah, that's right. Oh, no. Right, so Yechaniah is also the descendant of David HaMelech. This is where I got confused. The way I remember it, but I don't write this down because I'm not sure this is correct. The way I remember it is that Yechaniah is the son of Yehoyakim, and Sidkiyahu was the brother of Yehoyakim, the uncle of Yechaniah. That's the way I remember it, but the Rashis I see over here are not consistent with that, so I want to double check the line. They're both descendants of David HaMelech. But I don't remember how it all works out. But at the very end of the dynasty, right there before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, there was some confusion of uncles and sons, instead of being directly father, son. So, Beli Neder, I have a chart in a few places. I'll try to remember.
Where's the first person mentioned? Where's the first person mentioned as the first line of King David?
David is.
No,
we know he starts from Yehuda. Yehuda is, right? And Yehuda's son Peretz is 10 generations before David. That's Megillat Rus. That's where you would find that whole line. what we still have left to think about, and I don't know that I'm going to have an answer for you next week, but what we still have to think about over here is, so this is really the beginning of Yechezkel. This is the first, according to some of Farshim, this is the first Perek. And this is where Yechezkel is being told to tell the Jewish people what is going to happen to Tzidkiyahu because he violated the oath of Nebuchadnezzar. and all that happens over here. Question is, why is this not said 17 chapters ago? Why does it wait until here? Why do we need the first 16 prakim before being told this story in Perek Yud Zayin? We'll see in Perek Yud Ches, as we do that one, also some very interesting references, some somewhat well-known prophecies in Perek Yud Ches. Why is it out of order? This is one of those questions that you have in the Torah in general. We know the Torah also is not necessarily in chronological order. A prime example is this week's parasha, where in Parashas Ki Sisa, where we're told the story of the Egel Azav, the golden calf. Rashi says right away, it's out of order, because Truma and Tetzaveh, which were about the Mishkan, comes after the golden calf. That's fine and good. But then the question is, why does the Torah present it to us out of order? And that has to be answered. So here as well, we need to find the answer, why does Yechezkel start the way it does, and we finally get to the beginning over here in Pasuk Yud Zayin. As I said, I don't know if I'll have an answer for you next week, but something to think about. Yechezkel wrote a sefer, yeah. He did.
Hashem would have said,
yeah, this is the way Hashem wanted it done. That's right.